This lesson covers seven compact four-point arguments countering common assertions made by atheists and other skeptics. Clearly, for each of these seven topics, entire books could be offered. So the skeletons I'm presenting in this recorded lesson are just that, skeletons. And I think it's more helpful, particularly if we're new to apologetics or if we're trying to brush up our evidential skills, to work with a template. Just, even if this means rote memorization, just to learn these arguments, be able to reproduce them by memory without consulting notes. And then you can add to the structure. You can have another layer of complexity, or maybe instead of four responses to each assertion, you may have five or seven. So this is really meant to be the beginning, not the end. This is meant to be a suggestion and a model, not the final word on any of this. Number one, skeptics will say there's no proof of God. And let me emphasize that word. It's a demand for proof that, as it turns out, is somewhat unreasonable. My response, first, there's universal spiritual experience and testimony. Worldwide, we have not only stories of miracles, of the divine interpenetrating our own world, but many phenomena that are not easily taken account of or described by scientific method. Answered prayers alone, the resurrection of Christ, which we as Christians have become convinced of, point strongly to another world. Even though the conclusions may be somewhat ambivalent, near-death experiences also point strongly to something beyond this world. It doesn't mean that we have to accept all of the stories and anecdotes. I'm a big skeptic myself. I reject 99% of them. But I cannot reject all of them. So there's universal testimony to a spiritual world. Secondly, if we believe that God is immaterial, and God is spirit, John 4 says, God is everywhere simultaneously, He's transcendent and immanent, He's not physical. We don't believe that God is constituted of atoms, molecules, subatomic particles, or that He's pure energy, since energy and matter have been shown by physicists to be interconvertible. So insisting on empirical proof for God, that is, how much does He weigh? Let's measure Him with a Geiger counter. Let us, do a mass spec in the lab and see what substance this is. That's illogical, because by definition, God is not subject to the laws of science. It's not because He's better than the laws of science, though He is. It's that you could no more use the scientific lab to measure God than you could use a Geiger counter to measure light, or use a magnetometer to measure something else. You get the basic idea. So there are many things that cannot be proven empirically, but they're real nonetheless. Numbers. The whole area of mathematics, we accept it almost axiomatically, but you can't actually prove it. I mean, is the number seven real? What does that mean? How would you prove it? How would you even prove the identity theorem? A equals A. Fundamental philosophical truths. But we believe that they have a reality. As logic does, as numbers do, so do justice and love. And so there are many things that cannot be empirically proven, but that doesn't mean they're not real. The laboratory does not have the final say. Third, a universe with marks of intelligence and personality, like our own, is more likely to originate in a source that itself is personal and intelligent. our universe appears to be highly structured. And I'm not commenting now on elements of randomness or evolution or cosmology. That's somewhat irrelevant. The evidence of the universe is strong, that there's intelligence behind it, and that there's personality behind it. Otherwise, where did personality originate? Where does our sense of self and love and our determination to worship and so forth, how do you account for those in more than just a shallow way? So universe with these kinds of marks, intelligence and personality, is more likely to originate not just in an undifferentiated nothingness, but in a source that itself is personal and intelligent. And of course, as Christians, we've experienced God as being beyond our universe. He's transcendent, although he's immanent. He's in it as well. And the personality and the intelligence ultimately come from him. And then fourth, Christians have experienced God through Jesus Christ. A skeptic might say, well, I haven't experienced that. But that's not actually a logical response for him or her to counter my faith. I give the example of licorice because I'm a licorice lover. And I don't mean that artificial corn syrupy red stuff the Americans eat that's not licorice at all. I mean the real black stuff. And licorice in many cultures is sweet, but in some parts of Europe, they take it salty. I had heard of that, but until, maybe 20 years ago, I had never tasted it. Now, for me to say, well, I've never tasted it, it's not in my range of experience, therefore it cannot be real. Well, that's not any kind of an argument. Well, I've not experienced it, therefore it's not real. That may be nothing more than admitting my own ignorance. Now, I've developed these four responses to the first assertion, there's no proof of God. I develop them a little bit more than I will in the others, because I want you to see that our response to the skeptic is not just, now, here are four sentences for you. The point's not to be terse. We want to be concise if possible. That'll make it easier for us to learn. But what we want to do is be clear. We want people to understand what we're saying. Now, if I were being terse, I would say, well, firstly, no proof of God. There's spiritual experience worldwide in all generations. You're going against more than 99% of all mankind when you say that. And it only requires one example of there being something beyond the material world for your view of the materialistic world to collapse. So there's universal experience. Secondly, since God is not material, asking for scientific proof of God is unreasonable. Third, the universe that is characterized by intelligence and personality originates in a source that bears both of those qualities. As a Christian, I've experienced God through Jesus Christ. His reality, I invite you to do the same. So you can see what I'm saying. I'm giving you a bit more expansion in the first one, but now I'm going to be a bit more compact. What do we say when people protest, well, the Bible's been changed? Well, all of these responses are mentioned, as you see in the title. All these responses are rooted in the book Compelling Evidence. So if you find me going too fast, just go back and take a look at the book. The Bible's been changed. Well, first, the biblical story is not the kind that someone would make up if you were just inventing a religion. You know, for example, a lot of the leaders are put in a bad light. They're made to look dull. Their sin is sometimes spotlighted or highlighted, not covered up. There are parts of the scripture that seem to be contradictory. Now, if it was just a work of man, surely this would all be smoothed out. It's really not the kind of story we would make up. And if you don't believe me, study the scripture of other religions, and you'll see how qualitatively different it is. And number two, translators don't copy from translations of copies of copies of translations of copies. They work from the best available copies. The Dead Sea Scrolls prove that the Old Testament copyists were faithful over a 1,000-year period. It's good to know the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And third, the Greek manuscript, more than 5,000 before the invention of the printing press, show that the New Testament itself has been remarkably well copied. And finally, even if there were copying errors, why would a minor error disqualify the entire message? In the old days, they sent telegrams to announce births and other significant events. Well, what if someone spelled birth, brith, we rejoice in the birth of your daughter. Does that mean that we have no idea what he meant? Well, not at all. The fact that a little error has been made has nothing to do with the message. And it's fair to say that the text of the Bible has been preserved adequately. The message has remained unchanged. We should not claim that the text has been preserved perfectly, but the message has. Three, it's fashionable, particularly, well, it was fashionable in the around the turn of the century, that is around the year 1900, 1901, and again, in our time, fashionable to say that Jesus is merely a myth. One, there's strong historical evidence for the historical Jesus from a variety of sources. There are two valid reasons to accept the resurrection of Christ. Many people are unaware of those. The so-called parallels, particularly dying and rising gods or divinities who have 12 disciples, born of virgins and so forth, prove nothing. The parallels are not real parallels. And besides, in almost all cases, they're far too late. That is, a century or two after the time of Christ. And the disease of many scholars has been called parallelomania. And four, Jesus' followers, eyewitnesses, are unlikely to have been willing to die for a legend. And that's different from someone who is convinced by his leaders of the truth of his religion and stakes his life on it. But these people were in a position to know the source of the claims. Jesus is merely a myth. That's way too simplistic. I think sometimes we need to tell people when they throw these things out in such a cavalier, confident mood, that that's too simplistic. The truth, as reality often is actually more complex than you're making it out to be. Number four, all roads lead to God. Oh, so popular in our day. Well, the experts on world religions stress that the differences are greater than the similarities. Of course, there's some commonalities, but the differences are far greater. And in fact, to say that really we all believe the same thing is not just simplistic, it's offensive. I mean, tell a Muslim, really, he does believe Jesus is God's son. Tell a Christian, you really don't believe you'll have an eternal relationship with God. You'll just be reabsorbed into the world soul, you know, the Hindu view. Tell a Buddhist, well, you say you have no soul, but as Jews, we reject that. I mean, you can't both be right. So first, there's strong evidence for the differences outweigh the similarities. Second, Christianity offers great answers. I think the best answers to the fundamental questions of life. Origin, destiny, meaning, purpose, morality, relationship, identity. Third, and this is vital to insist upon, we must not confuse tolerance of persons with tolerance of ideas. An illustration may get this across very simply. A weak faith. It's better to have a weak faith in a strong bridge than a strong faith in a weak bridge. Why is that? Well, because your belief about the bridge doesn't determine whether you can cross the chasm or not. Your belief may lay hold of that truth, but in no way does it create it. Faith doesn't create truth. Okay, tolerance of persons means I think you're wrong, I accept you as a human being. If we interact, I'm going to stand up to my view. That's tolerance of persons. But in our generation, it's been redefined as tolerance of ideas. No one's right, no one's wrong. Or everyone's right, or everyone's wrong. Or no one has more of a claim on truth than anyone else, and it's offensive to think that you're right, that your view is correct. Which, of course, is self-contradictory because the person uttering that sentiment believes that he's right and that you're wrong. So we mustn't confuse tolerance of persons with tolerance of ideas. And fourthly, Christianity may be exclusive, of course, because any positive claims it makes, because truth is inherently exclusive, rule out the opposite. Yet Christianity is also inclusive, and there's a grand vision of all the world being encompassed in the redeemed. People from every tribe and language, from every nation, look at Revelation chapter 7. Science contradicts faith. First, well, then why do the majority of scientists believe in a personal God? A little bit less than the majority actually accept Christianity, and even fewer believe that they're Christians and accept the scripture. But the majority believe in a personal God. Now that's quite something. Second, the Big Bang Theory suggest a creator. Did you know that? Evolution has to do with the how, not the why. In other words, the Bible tells us the why. Scientists can tell us the how. But to pit science against Genesis is really unfair. Refer to the podcast on questions from Genesis. And fourth, God's book of words and his book of works are complementary. The book of words, scripture. The book of works, nature. Psalm 19, Romans 1. So the Bible is not a science textbook. It's a story about relationships, and particularly God's desire for a relationship with us, his creatures. And we understand reality best with the two books. And that's what's called the two books, the book of works, the book of words. Science does not contradict faith. Some scientists contradict faith, but that's a different point. Six, what about the religious wars? I think we begin, one, admitting that things done in the name of Christ have been horrific, unjustified. Things like the Inquisition, for example, or the pogroms. Yeah, the fact that they are done in the name of Christ hardly proves that they are caused by Christ. Two, it's true that many have been killed in religious wars, but atheistic governments kill too. In the 20th century, some 100 million perished at the hands of such anti-Christian figures as Hitler and Stalin, Mao and Pol Pot. If you think faith is dangerous, well, unbelief is even more treacherous. Three, the cause of war are complex, but I think most would see that the desire for power, political, economic power, lies at the core, not religion. In other words, people do things in the name of religion more than they'll just do something in the name of an economic theory. Religion becomes a pretext more than an actual cause. And four, whereas the Old Testament regulated violence, and it is a more violent world back then than the New Testament, the New Testament forbids it. Jesus said that in Matthew 5, Paul in Romans 12. Christianity is not political, it's apolitical. Or as Paul put it, our struggle is not against flesh and blood. And so those are the four things that I would begin with in responding to the common assertion that, you know, there are religious wars, and therefore, this is unstated, it's implied that religion is bad, or as one atheist says, religion poisons everything. That, again, proves simplistic. Seven, the evil in the world means that there's no God. Well, at least not the God that you're talking about. There's no good God. Well, firstly, there's a deep philosophical problem, which I've tried to highlight in the early chapters of Compelling Evidence. Because without an external moral standard, that is, without an absolute God who's in some sense outside our world, there's nothing by which to measure virtue or vice. Who's to say something is evil? If there's no God, then there is ultimately no good or evil. Whatever is right. So to say that I can't believe in a God because there's evil in the world, well, if there weren't God, you couldn't logically hold that there was evil in the world. Don't confuse that with, well, things I find unpleasant. Because what's unpleasant to you may be someone else's virtue. So evil has to be defined, framed in some way. Two, as far as we understand, a world with free will requires the potential for sin, pain, and suffering. And that's integral to humanity. Take away free will, I don't think any of us understands how we would be human. And so you'd say, well, couldn't God make a world where there was free will but no potential for sin? Well, no, because that's illogical. I don't think God's capable of illogic. Third, Christianity offers neither simplistic answers nor escape from pain. Even though Christ's followers sometimes look for simplistic answers, like in John 9, verses 1 to 3, Christianity doesn't give the facile answer, and it certainly doesn't say, follow us and life will go better and you'll have no pain. Really, the opposite. And finally, God himself enters our world, the incarnation, meeting us in our pain of the cross, the crucifixion. Out of this event, Jesus calls us to a cruciform life. Well, there you have it. I limited the discussion to just seven common assertions. I've given you only four responses to each. There's no proof of God. The Bible's been changed. Jesus is merely a myth. All roads lead to God. Science contradicts faith. Religious wars show that somehow, you know, religion is bad. And the evil in the world means that there's no God, at least no good God. Learn these. I urge you to memorize them, internalize them, until you could reproduce them orally or verbally on paper without looking at your notes. In other words, I think in this case it's actually very good to learn it cold, learn it rote, and then take that as the beginning, and then improve. I hope this will be a blessing to you in your faith and in your outreach.